Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming live from London. This is Owen Bennett-Jones. So, the hostage and prisoner releases in Gaza and Israel are still on track. Today, six Israelis have been released. Two of them have been held for as long as a decade. 600 Palestinians should be freed this evening. In Gaza, a large crowd gathered in the rain and the hostages were paraded in two separate ceremonies there. And in Tel Aviv, there were cheers as Israelis watched the Red Cross take the hostages under its care. Well, Yael Alexander is the mother of Idan Alexander, one of the Israeli hostages who's actually still being held by Hamas. She told the BBC she is looking forward to the time her son and other remaining hostages will be released.
So I'm seeing this release. I'm here in Tel Aviv. I came a week ago from Jersey. I don't know. I'm hopeful, you know, to see the hostages on their feet. It's amazing, after so long that we didn't know much about them, just to see them alive and released from captivity, it's amazing. And I actually can see when it's going to be our time, like to get it done back. There is more than dozens young men alive, like my son, still waiting to be released. And we need to, this is the main goal, to release the live people now from Gaza.
Well, as I say, some Palestinians also gathered to watch the hostages being handed over to the Red Cross. And these onlookers in the southern Gaza city of Rafah gave their reaction.
I pray to God the Almighty that this truce will be fully implemented. We do not want war. We do not want bombings. We want peace, security and safety in our beloved Gaza Strip. Praise be to God for what we have lost. May He compensate us. I say this as someone who belongs to no faction. I am a daughter of Rafah, and I stand wholeheartedly with the resistance.
I'm here to watch the handover of detainees. We stand firm on this land, sending a message to Trump and Netanyahu. We remain steadfast. Netanyahu claimed in the media that he eliminated the resistance, but here is a glimpse of the youths who make us proud.
Well, for many in Israel, the ceasefire with Hamas has been controversial, with three members of the Israeli cabinet resigning, but others want the process to continue, including Boaz Bismut, a member of the Knesset for Prime Minister Netanyahu's Likud party.
I hate it, but this is the only option I have right now, meaning, I mean, I have to release my fellow citizens from Gaza, especially when I see the way that they were hijacked, kidnapped, and the fact also the way they are treated over there. And this is why I have objectives in this war. Yet the urgent one is to bring them back, knowing perfectly well that it's not angels that are going out of our prisons, it's terrorists. But Israel has no planning of to stay in Gaza. Yet Hamas will not stay there.
So let's go live to Tel Aviv now. And the BBC's Mark Lowen is there. And I guess so far the day has gone according to these very intricate plans.
It has, Owen, yes, and really according to the kind of weekly ritual that we have seen with crowds gathered here on Hostages Square, watching the live feed from another world, in a sense, from the wasteland of Gaza, and that Hamas stage-managed show that we see in which the hostages are led out by Hamas fighters onto a stage which is festooned with propaganda posters, all very much designed to show the world that Hamas are still there. They have not been totally annihilated, as Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, said that they would be. The last of the hostages, we understand, is now in the hands of the Red Cross. That is Hisham al-Sayed, who was one of the two who had crossed into Gaza several years ago. The other four of the six released today were all seized on the 7th of October, and they've been now reunited with their families and are en route, the last couple of them, but the first two already in hospital now for several days of medical checks.
Yeah, and then the next bit of this is the release of some Palestinian prisoners, many of them.
Yeah, more than 600 Palestinian prisoners will be freed from a jail in the occupied West Bank, the Offa prison. The majority of them were arrested since October the 7th. Several dozen of them are serving long sentences or life sentences for some of the most violent attacks, but many of them are held for what Israel calls administrative detention, in other words, held without charge. So there will also be joy and relief on that side of this divide, Owen, as they are reunited with their families. But for the family of Shiri Bibas, whose body was returned here to Israel finally in the early hours of this morning, there is no time. It is too late for the reuniting and for the celebrations, and her husband Yarden Bibas will now be able to lay her body to rest along with their two little boys, Ariel and Kafir.
As all this has been going on, there's been more violence, hasn't there, on the West Bank. What can you tell us?
Yeah, there's been a lot of... The Israeli operations in the West Bank have led to the death of at least 50 Palestinians there since the Gaza ceasefire was signed in mid-January. There are 20,000 people alone who have been displaced in Jenin. That is an area of the West Bank that Israel calls a hotbed of terror. But those there say that actually what Israel's government is doing is using this all as a pretext to achieve what its ultimate aim is, which is annexation of the occupied West Bank. That is the fear among Palestinians, that this government in Israel, the most right-wing government in Israel's history, will use, in a sense, the kind of focus of media attention on Gaza to do what it really wants to do in the West Bank, which is to annex it, and also that will be enabled by Donald Trump, who said a couple of weeks ago that he would announce within 4 weeks his plan for the West Bank. We're waiting to see what he has to say. I mean, since the 7th of October attacks, at least 900 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank and occupied Jerusalem. And added to that, Owen, are the increasing attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank. So the real fear there, and among critics of this government, is that with all the glare of focus on Gaza, Benjamin Netanyahu will kind of placate the right wingers in his government and actually achieve what they have long harboured, which is the annexation of the West Bank.
Okay, thanks very much. That was the BBC's Mark Lowen there in Tel Aviv. So just to catch up with where we've got to on this whole ceasefire process, and we'll have a look at where it might go, because it all started on the 15th of January, at least that's when it was announced, and there were three stages. Phase one, ceasefire. Hamas released 33 hostages. Israel released 1,900 prisoners. Stage two, permanent ceasefire, with remaining living hostages in Gaza exchanged for more prisoners, Palestinian prisoners, and complete Israeli withdrawal. Then stage three, return of all remaining bodies of dead hostages and the reconstruction of Gaza. Well, that was negotiated. Then President Trump came into power and talked about the US taking over Gaza in some way. So where are we now? Professor Yossi Meckelberg is a senior consulting fellow at Chatham House, UK think tank. And we're basically at the end of stage one, aren't we?
Good afternoon. Yes, it's stage one. You know, it almost looks like eternity, but it created at least some momentum. You know, there were violations from both sides of the agreement, but the gist of it, of the hostages coming back, humanitarian aid entering into Gaza, the return of many of Palestinians to their place of origins, and the release of the Palestinian prisoners. So there is some momentum there, some mechanism that work with the help of the mediators. But now we are entering into probably the most difficult of phases, the second one, because both sides will have to give up some of their main bargaining chips. From Hamas' point of view, the hostages and the remaining of the hostages, and from Israel, is to agree to the end of war.
Yeah, exactly. And you would think that given what's happened in Washington, there must be the possibility that if all the remaining hostages are released, then the conflict will just start again.
It's a possibility, because there are pressures from the right wing in Israel. They don't agree to the end of war. One party already left the coalition, but they are ready to return to the coalition on condition that the war is not ending, and they will they call the complete elimination of Hamas. But even the far-right party led by Smotrich, that is still in the coalition, they disagree with that. And without them, Netanyahu doesn't have a majority in the Knesset. And as we know, for Netanyahu, the main priority is to stay in power, especially when he's still facing his corruption trial.
Is there any way Netanyahu can stay in power without that right-wing support?
It's not very likely. He can get the support from the opposition, and he will get to continue with the agreement for all the phases. But they are not going to prompt him until the election on 2026. So for a while, maybe, but not in the long term, because this is also what the Israeli people say. They want a different government. Poll after poll, they say that they want Netanyahu out. Not that it's guaranteed that it will happen in election. He survived many other elections.
Right.
But it's without the right wing, he will find it very difficult to stay in power.
He is an amazing political survivor. So can you just tell us what those polls actually say? How strong is the support for the non-Netanyahu forces, if you like?
We'll see. Continues that the parties in the right now in opposition will have a majority, quite a stable majority within the Knesset. If you have 120, it shows towards a majority of 68 to 70 to the opposition parties.
Okay, and now stage two that we've been talking about, which is more releases and a permanent ceasefire, the talks are meant to have started on that, right, but haven't?
Well, there are some talks in Doha, in Qatar, but they're very slow pace. And part of it has to do with dealing with phase one, obviously with what I see is an irresponsible statement coming from Washington about, and from the President Trump, about basically the forceful expulsion of more than 2 million people from Gaza. This doesn't help. And also the violation, I think also the Hamas, what happened in the last few days, especially by the parading of hostages, and especially of coffins. I think any negotiation needs to build some trust, and this doesn't exist. So it makes it more and more difficult, in addition to the pressure within the Israel in the government and on Hamas. But again, that's what the mediators are so important. The role of Washington is important to try and achieve progress on phase two.
Thank you so much. That was Professor Yossi Mechelberg there from Chatham House. And coming up a little later on NewsHour, as Germany's far-right AfD party is in second place before tomorrow's general election, we hear from one recent Syrian immigrant about her life in Berlin.
As a refugee, you need to be hard worker. I have a lot of conversation with AfD people. Start to talk about, did you pay your taxes? I told them, maybe more than you. Did you let your children go to school and learn German? I told him, for sure. They know about Christmas. Listen, I'm Muslim, but my grandmother, she's Christian. And after that, he said, I don't have a problem with the example like you.
More from her and from NewsHour's Jamie Kumarasamy in Berlin in around 15 minutes. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has urged UN members to approve a new US proposed resolution on Ukraine. The text doesn't mention Ukrainian territory occupied by Russia. Now, there's also a rival European text demanding an immediate withdrawal of all Moscow's forces from Ukraine. So quite different tones. Tony Brenton used to be the British ambassador to Moscow. How does he see these votes coming up on Monday? Will Europe and the US both insist on their resolutions being presented to the General Assembly, or will there be a fudge?
there will be procedural arguments in the run-up to the vote on Monday, and it's not at all clear how it's going to come out. It may well end up that both resolutions end up being voted on. It's worth emphasising that this is theatre, that this has no serious implications for the way the peace negotiations are going to go, when on the assumption we get there. It is interesting, however, that for the first time in living memory, you have the US on the one hand and Europe on the other hand putting up rival resolutions. In the past, it's always been a united Western draft resolution, which is actually passed with enormous support. What the voting will reveal is how much support there is for Ukraine in the global South. That's essentially the distinction between the two resolutions, and it will be interesting to see.
What's your take on what's happening in the substantive negotiations? I guess all this talk of rare earth minerals could be dressed up as US investment. And maybe it is US investment. How do you see that?
We've had pretty much a last week, actually, where what felt at the beginning like the US getting down to serious negotiations, causing immense irritation because it's handling Ukraine on a separate track from Russia and looking as if it's not going to deal with Europe at all until it absolutely has to. Trump then got into this really quite ugly row with Zelensky just 3 or 4 days ago, which has convinced everyone, as I read this morning's press and talk to one or two people, that the US has turned against Ukraine and is prepared to throw them to the dogs in order to get the peace treaty they want. I think that's an exaggerated conclusion. I think what is going on in the White House is a planned negotiating, tactical negotiating strategy based on the observation, firstly, that finally they can control Ukraine and how Ukraine behaves, and they're not going to put up with the sort of criticism that Zelensky threw at Trump a couple of days ago. There's very bad blood between the two men anyway, and none of this has helped. But the American calculation is the real obstacle to getting the peace treaty is going to be Russia. The Russians think they're winning the war at the moment. The US do not have Russia in their pocket in the way they have Ukraine. And therefore, what the US is doing is love bomb. Hence the resolution in the UN, cutting out any criticism. Hence their avoidance of criticism in a G7, remote G7 meeting, which is taking place about now. All the rest of it. They're getting rid of a lot of anti-Russian rhetoric in order to get the Russians on board for a serious attempt to get a peace treaty.
The obvious answer to that is, why give everything to Russia before the negotiations begin?
Well, I don't think they've given anything to Russia. Everybody knew. There's been lots of accusations against the US of giving away non-NATO membership for Ukraine and giving away Ukraine's loss of territory. But in fact, it has been absolutely clear, and everybody close to the negotiation has known this for a long time, that Ukraine is not going to join NATO. The Russians are absolutely adamant that they will not. One of the key reasons why Russia started the war was to prevent that, so it's not going to happen. Similarly, Ukraine's expected loss of some of its territory, Zelensky himself conceded at the moment when Trump said he was going to press for quick peace. So they've not conceded anything which is not already, in effect, conceded. The serious negotiation, which will be about what guarantees can the West give to Ukraine to ensure that it survives as an independent, democratic nation once peace is made, has not yet been engaged. And that's going to be the real nub of the negotiation.
The analysis there of a former UK ambassador to Moscow, Tony Brenton. Well, Boris Bondarov is a former Russian foreign ministry official who worked at the Russian permanent mission at the UN in Geneva, but then resigned in protest over the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So he's someone who took a stand. How does he analyse what's happened in US-Russian relations since Trump's come to power?
Trump is eager to change US foreign policy very drastically, to be very much unlike his predecessor. And also, I think he wants to achieve some of very important foreign political goals for the United States by making Vladimir Putin his friend or even an ally against China. I think that is most obvious and logical explanation to all his maneuvers around Putin.
Yes, that's interesting you say that, because there's lots of speculation in the United States as to why President Trump seems so pro-President Putin, yeah, in his first term and his second term now. But you think it's all to do with China?
Maybe not all, but I think that the primary reason, if we try to find reasons in Trump's policy, should be around China, because Trump has always stated that to contain China, to compete with China strategically, economically, is his main goal. And he considers China to be a United States rival. Evidently, Putin's Russia is not a rival in Trump's eyes. It's a small economy, it's a huge nuclear arsenal, and it's better to have Vladimir Putin out of this, you know, bilateral US-China competition.
Let's just sort of, for the sake of argument, say you're right, and it's basically his main concern is China. Do you think this policy of isolation will help the United States assert itself vis-a-vis China?
I think no, and I have doubts, because Trump may lie to himself that he could make this split between China and Russia. But the truth is that Russia is very much dependent on China right now. 36% of Russian foreign trade is with China. And China has been a steady, predictable, and very reliable partner and supporter of Vladimir Putin for the last 3 years. And Putin knows that in China, in Beijing, he has a reliable supporter and partner. And the United States is everything right now, but predictable.
You're living in Switzerland. You obviously get the European perspective as well. Europe, the European Union, has never had a unified foreign policy, really. Do you think it will now need to get one, or does it not need one and can continue just thinking about trade and not assert itself internationally?
It depends on whether Europeans want to play its own independent role and to have a say in the world's matters, or they are quite satisfied with how Trump treats them, like without any respect, without considering them to be equals. The European Union doesn't need strategy right now. It needs it 3 years ago, at least, when the war has started. For these 3 years, Europeans have not produced anything which could be characterized as a strategy or a plan of action. And if you, as someone said, when you don't know where to sail, no wind is favorable.
Well, I mean, is that quite fair? I mean, the European Union may not have had such a strategy, but nor did the United States, did it? I mean, you know, they were pretty much in lockstep in allowing Ukraine to defend itself, but not to inflict a defeat on Russia.
Absolutely, absolutely. The United States didn't, and they haven't yet produced any sustainable strategy either. But the United States, I think they can afford it more than Europe can.
So one of the questions that's beginning to be asked is, are the changes that Trump are making irreversible? Or if in 2 years, you know, American politics does its thing and the Democrats make a big comeback in Congress and he looks much weaker, will this moment pass?
I'm an outsider, but my impression is that Trump hasn't yet done much in real action. Yeah, in terms, he has spoken a lot, but his actions are not that, you know, impressive so far. But I think his rhetoric has already damaged the trust between America and Europe. America will never be again a trusted partner as it used to be. But it looks quite dangerous right now.
And that's former Russian diplomat Boris Bondarov there. You're listening to NewsHour on the World Service of the BBC. Now let's head to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the M23 rebels appear to be continuing their advance after capturing two big cities in recent weeks in the east of the country. Now, on Friday, the UN Security Council, for the first time, passed a resolution calling on Rwanda to withdraw its forces from the DRC and end its support for the rebels. Kigali denies it does that. The resolution urges both Rwanda and Congo to engage in talks to achieve peace. Well, my colleague Julian Warwicker has been speaking to the DRC ambassador to the UN, Zenon Nge Mugonga.
It has been more than 20 years. We have never got a resolution naming Rwanda expressly like the Security Council did, and also condemning Rwanda openly and seeking Rwanda to withdraw from the territory. We expect the Security Council to make a lot of pressure, and also the powerful countries to put more pressure on Rwanda to withdraw from the territory of Congo, because we know that this is acknowledgement of the invasion of a country by another country, and we know what the consequences of the invasion are.
There's one aspect of this resolution that I wanted to put to you, namely that it condemns support by Congolese troops to specific armed groups, in particular the FDLR, the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda. So there's criticism in this resolution of your country as well. How do you respond to that?
We have no problem with that. You'll recall that the last round of this Rwanda process was to sign an agreement between President Tshisekedi and President Kagame. And that agreement was related to this question of FDLR.
Mm. But the UN experts only in December said that the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo was continuing to use FDLR fighters as proxies.
It's not the government per se. There are some ties between some officers with some FDLR, but it's not a policy of the government of Congo, actually.
Rwanda, as you know, rejects the allegations that it supports M23 with arms and troops, and you've just explained why you don't accept that position. Is there any realistic chance of yourselves and Rwanda sitting down to try and resolve this issue?
We were on the table of negotiation in Rwanda.
Indeed.
As I said, it
on
but the
we are still where we
December.
Are.
Yeah. Rwanda was the one who left the table of negotiation. But for the time being, as you have witnessed on the ground, there's a lot of killing going on in the territory of Congo. So Rwanda have to withdraw. I believe there will be a couple of meetings to put forward the mechanism of a withdrawal for Rwanda so that peace can come back.
And that was the DRC ambassador to the UN, said on Ngaye Mugungu, there speaking with Julian Warwicker. There's a big moment coming up in Germany. Elections are on tomorrow, and with the growing rift between the US and Europe, they take on ever more importance internationally, that is, and domestically. The economy is still in recession. Migration has been a big part of the campaign. And we've got on the road for us James Kumarasamy joining us live from Berlin. So take it away.
Thanks, Owen. Yes, well, today's news that the man suspected of stabbing and seriously injuring a Spanish tourist at the Holocaust Memorial here in Berlin yesterday evening is a Syrian refugee. Is only going to add to the sense during this election campaign that large-scale immigration has brought insecurity to the streets of Germany. It's just the latest in a series of well-publicised attacks involving asylum seekers and immigrants. And that's helped to boost the ratings of the AfD. That's the party on the far or the radical right, which takes the toughest stance on border control and is now even talking of remigration, thought to mean that the mass deportation of people with migrant backgrounds. Yes, immigration is certainly something that has been high on voters' concerns here during this election campaign. The AfD currently standing around 20% in the opinion polls, higher than it's ever been, and second just behind the CDU, the Christian Democrats, whose candidate for Chancellor Friedrich Merz looks set to be the man who will lead Germany after Sunday. And in one of the key moments of the campaign, he actually effectively teamed up with the AfD to pass a parliamentary motion, a non-binding one, though, that tightened Germany's borders. Now, that earned him a slap on the wrist from Angela Merkel, who famously opened Germany's border to more than a million refugees, many of them Syrian, of course, 10 years ago. But a lot has changed since then. And here in Berlin, I've been hearing about different sides of the complicated immigration experience, beginning with one of the Syrians who came to Germany in that 2015 Merkel wave. She actually ended up cooking for the former chancellor. Well, this is a rather charming Syrian restaurant in the Schönberg district, and you can probably hear preparations in full swing for tonight's customers who are being treated to lovely starters like tabouleh, fattoush. Now, we're very excited to meet the owner of this place. Her name's Malakai Jasmati. She's one of the Syrians who came to Germany a decade ago, and she's made a real success of things.
As a refugee, I leave my Damascus, and it's not easy to leave your homeland, because homeland, it's like mother. When I come to here, start cooking for my friends. Step by step, I surprised now to cook for Angela Merkel. She asked me about the food. She asked me about the recipe of shawarma, because she fell in love with my shawarma.
How do you think of Germany? You say that your mother is Damascus, but how do you think of Germany?
She's my friend, my close friend. When you will close your eyes and think about your close friend, you will be emotional and happy. That's it's my emotion with Berlin.
Now, what would you say then to people who are looking at what's happening in Germany at the moment and say, look, this party on the far right, the AfD, is doing very well. The CDU is also being more tough on immigration, and we'll look at Germany and wonder if it's still a welcoming country, it's still a good country for people to come to. What would you say?
As a refugee, you need to be hard worker. I have a lot of conversation with AfD people. Start to talk about, did you pay your taxes? I told him, maybe more than you. Did you let your children go to school and learn German? I told him, for sure. They know about Christmas. Listen, I'm Muslim, but my grandmother, she's Christian. And after that, he said, I don't have a problem with the example like you. What do you mean? Syrian people, they helping you. How many doctors, Syrian doctors we have? Did you imagine if those doctors come back to Syria? What it's happened? Da-da-da-da. Don't judge us. You need us.
Hello, you're live with BBC News. I'm Anna Foster here in the German city of Magdeburg, a city in shock this afternoon after five...
But it's the recent spate of attacks by asylum seekers and immigrants, not the work of Syrian doctors or chefs, that explains why immigration has been at the top of German voters' minds, as well as where the attacks are happening, according to Susan Fratzke from the Migration Policy Institute.
Even if there's a low risk of being the victim of an attack that's committed by a migrant, if you tell someone that, that won't necessarily change their perception of that threat. And that's particularly true for the types of crimes that we've seen recently in Germany, which have been really, you know, highly visible and dramatic crimes, like the attack that we saw on the Christmas market in Magdeburg. And in Germany, I think these types of visible events have been particularly salient for people because of how important public gatherings and these types of festivals are.
We have it's security glass.
Although it's smashed up there.
Here somebody tried to throw the fire inside. There were two people inside and they couldn't come out because somebody locked the door from outside. So people would have died here inside. They also wrote...
In the Neukölln district of Berlin, the local integration officer, Gunnar Balci, shows me the site of a less well-known but potentially deadly attack on a cafe bar that's taken a strong stand against anti-Semitism and homophobia.
Well, Neukölln is one of the poorest and also one of the biggest districts we have in Berlin. And in the last years, we had a lot of people coming here from Syria and Iran, Iraq. We really have a problem by finding apartments, flats for the people who come here in the last years. Sometimes it's not really easy to find a school place. We have a large number of, I call them reactionary mosques. And these mosques, they also offer Quran lessons, and they are very successful in spreading their ideology into the minds of kids. And a lot of what kids learn there is really against democratic values.
So when political parties say, look, these new arrivals could be a danger to German society, are they right?
Well, the new arrivals are not the danger for the German society. It is how we handle them. People see what happens in their neighborhoods.
They see what happened here.
They see what happens here, and they realize that there are problems that the democratic parties were not able to talk about because they never wanted to be called racist. But it's not racism to talk about problems and to try to solve them.
Gunnar Balci, the integration officer for the Neukölln district. Interesting hearing a talk about the democratic parties. That's what you often hear people describe, parties that aren't the AfD or parties on the far left. But a lot of Germans, it seems, are likely to vote for them. Let's turn to the election itself. And Germany's electoral system is really designed for coalition government. But as we saw with the outgoing Olaf Scholz government, which fell apart, if the ingredients don't gel, they can be a recipe for division. Well, Thomas Koenig is a political analyst at the University of Mannheim in southwest Germany. I asked him what he's going to be looking out for in the results.
There is one decisive decision, whether the parties will be able to form a two-party coalition or whether they need to form a three-party coalition, which depends on the success of the smaller parties.
But when it comes to the bigger parties, you don't think there's any doubt that the Christian Democrats will be top and that Friedrich Merz will form the next government?
It looks like that. You know, he has, according to the polls, a relatively stable advantage against the AfD of about almost 10 points, against the SPD with the former chancellor, about 15 points. So it's very unlikely that one of the two will still be able to pass him. What we saw in German politics over the past whatever few years is the potential candidates for a two-party coalition, the Greens and the SPD, they moved towards the left more, while the CDU, the Union, moved towards the right. So it's very difficult if the two or a coalition wants to have more policy change, what in particular the voters have in mind, to fulfill these two parties with diverging positions.
Let's talk about the AfD. It is on course to do better than it has done in any election before. What is driving that?
First of all, if you look at the polls, then you see a quite divided Germany. So more or less, the AfD will win, or is likely to win, almost all districts in the east, while the CDU is almost all winning districts in the west. And the AfD, I mean, the migration issue helped the party, the Ukraine war helped the party. There are lots of things which motivate the people, in particular in the east, to support the AfD.
When you say the Ukraine war motivated them, this is a party that is more pro Russian than certainly the CDU, the SPD. So that is a popular position in the East, is it?
Of course. I mean, if you look at the history of the East was occupied by the Soviet Union, right? So the people have still these, let's say, fears about the big brother who was there for a long, long time. They don't feel a negative sentiment to vote for a kind of a right-wing extremist party because they have historically the impression that they were not part of the Hitler Nazi regime, so not responsible for the Second World War.
A question about the generational divide. Are we seeing here in Germany new patterns of voting, potentially?
The younger voters have, let's say, not yet a stable, whatever, party identification. And of course, just the youngest generation has no whatever positive perspective for the future of their jobs, pensions, whatever, living, etc. in Germany. And therefore, the young people are inclined to more support AfD also in the West.
That was Thomas Koenig, political analyst. Just interesting on what he was saying there at the end. We were hearing today from some younger voters and saying that the AfD is particularly strong on social media, on platforms like TikTok, and a lot of young people are getting a lot of their information from there.
Okay. Now, Jamie, just tell us, when will we know what's happened tomorrow? How does it work?
Well, it's pretty swift and efficient, as you might imagine. At 6 o'clock, the local time, 6 p.m. local time, the polls close. And soon after that, you get the initial preliminary results. Now, that should give us a sense of Friedrich Merz, if, as all the polls have suggested, that he is the largest party, the CDU. But then a lot of the interest will be on how some of the smaller parties have done. We've talked a bit about the coalition there, and a lot's going to depend on which parties cross the 5% barrier that they need to get into the Bundestag, into the parliament. And that will give him the options that he has to form a coalition. That could take some time, but the horse trading will start immediately, and a lot is at stake. I have to say, a real sense of anticipation, nervousness amongst the Germans I've been speaking to. They all feel that there is a lot at stake. If they didn't already, I think the way Donald Trump has thrown up in the air the certainties of European security have only added to that. So it's going to be a very interesting election. We'll have full coverage, of course, here on NewsHour tomorrow.
Thanks very much indeed. Yeah, it's a big election. Look forward to listening to all of that. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. Amidst all the talk of Ukraine and Gaza in recent weeks, there is another cultural front line in the United States under President Trump, and that is the world of scientific research. To give just one example, the US Epidemiological Society will not be meeting this year. An email about that being called off went out a couple of days ago. Professor Walter Willett is Professor of Epidemiology and Nutrition at Harvard. What changes has the Trump administration made?
There have been many changes, and I could go on for quite a while. They come under several major categories. One is obstructing communication and censorship, withholding funding, and blocking collaboration. And I could go into more detail in any of those.
That's a lot. So when you say stopping communication, that's conferences being canceled.
It's more than that. It's scientists who work at NIH and other national research laboratories have essentially been gagged. They can't travel to joint scientific meetings and they can't attend virtually. That means that some big meetings have been canceled, like the American Epidemiologic Society meeting that is coming up in a few weeks was canceled because those working at the Centers for Disease Control and NIH, who are a large part of the membership, couldn't attend. And that means that scientists working to reduce the burden of chronic diseases and prevent epidemics can't communicate with each other. And that really puts our country at risk.
Epidemiology, is that due to vaccine skepticism? What's behind it?
It's hard to know what's behind that, but a lot of what we're talking about is preventing epidemics, and not just infectious disease epidemics, but obviously, and this is recognized actually by our new leadership in Washington, that Americans are not healthy, but some of the things that are being said are not scientifically supported, and we really need to have the best science directed to those kinds of conditions.
Are you saying that the changes that have come in since January the 20th go into stopping America's long track record of deep scientific, publicly funded research?
Yes, and that is a terrible loss. We've accomplished a lot. We are living about 10 years longer, and that's a healthy 10 years longer than we were back in the 1950s and 1960s. So this idea that we need to make America healthy again is based on a faulty idea that we were much healthier 40 or 50 years ago. We're just now having a good look at how diet affects cancer, the long-term effects of additives.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned that. Presumably that will continue because the new health secretary, Kennedy, is very supportive of controlling ultra-processed foods.
That's hard to know. And some of the things that he's said are, in fact, not consistent with science. For example, seed oils are healthy, not unhealthy. And loading up on beef tallow, that's what we were doing 50 years ago, which we found was not a good idea. Ideally, he will put more resources into that, but those decisions need to be guided by good science.
And that was Walter Willett, Professor of Epidemiology and Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. You're listening to NewsHour. The film director Ali Abbasi is Iranian-born but now based in Denmark. And a few months ago, his film The Apprentice was struggling to get distribution in the United States because of its subject matter. It's all about Donald Trump and his early friendship with the New York lawyer Roy Cohn. But now its two stars are both nominated for Oscars, so it's very high profile. And Vincent Dowd has been speaking to Ali Abbasi.
Hello, this is Donald Trump from Mr. Cohn. Thank you so much.
Donald who?
Yeah, you're brutal.
Work on a feature film on the pre-politics Donald Trump began in his first White House term. In the Biden years, the idea progressed. But then, says director Ali Abbasi, some financial backers developed cold feet.
The closer we got to the elections, the more jittery they became. And at some point, you know, some of the financiers, they wanted to pressure us into cutting scenes that they felt could make him angry, basically. We had to buy out our reluctant American investors.
When eventually the film was released, Donald Trump branded it a cheap, defamatory and politically disgusting hatchet job. But there's been praise for actor Sebastian Stan, Academy Award nominated for playing Mr. Trump in his 20s.
From the sea to the sky, some say the age of Trump has begun.
Trump Tower, Trump City, Trump Plaza, Trump Castle. Does he go?
At first, Stan makes him sympathetic as Donald Trump finds a much-needed mentor in wealthy New York lawyer and businessman Roy Cohn. Portrayed as slightly naive, Trump is taken aback to realise that Cohn is gay and at his ruthless business methods.
This is the most important rule of all, okay? No matter how beaten you are, you claim victory and never admit defeat. Never admit defeat.
Playing Cohn is Jeremy Strong, star of the hit series Succession. He's nominated as Best Supporting Actor as the hugely forceful lawyer feared and admired in the New York business world. Would you say that the relationship between Trump and Cohn is the core of the movie? In a funny sort of way, it's almost like a love story.
Yeah, it is a love story. When I read the historical accounts of how they met and, you know, knowing that young Donald would fit perfectly, actually, as Roy Cohn's type, tall, blonde, sort of a little bit innocent and provincial, it could have started as almost like, you know, Roy had a crush on it. But then as it develops, I think there was genuine love and affection, you know, and by that, I don't mean in necessarily a sexual way. And Donald saw in Roy a mentor figure or a father figure.
The dysfunctional relationship with his father, Fred, suggested by the film, may be a reason why Donald Trump has so disliked it, along with a scene of violence against his first wife, Ivana. The story ends before Trump finds fame on American TV, but by then, says Ali Abbasi, the cinema audience can see what lies ahead.
He's bullied his way into his business, getting into politics, becoming president, to silence the media, to get the oligarchy on his side. And I think it's really dangerous to start to adapt to a bully mindset. I know certainly what I'm talking about in that respect, because I come from Iran, and the bully mentality rules in Iran. But it doesn't matter how I feel about President Trump of the United States right now, but it was certainly not the plan to do a political hit job or a critique of him, but to depict these people as human beings. And I think the more important thing, for me at least, was to be in conversation with what's going on.
Mr. Trump's lawyers described The Apprentice as a concoction of lies that repeatedly defames President Trump and constitutes direct foreign interference in America's elections. But the fact it has two performances, nominated at the Oscars on March the 2nd, has given it a media profile in America which had appeared unlikely.
Don't you forget, I made you.
And there we are. That was Vincent Dowd speaking to Ali Abbasi and bringing us to an end of this edition of NewsHour. So thanks very much for listening. And from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London, goodbye.